And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Catherine Austin Fitz about the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization, both the topic and the upcoming conference as well. And we have much more to discuss. I wanted to begin to ask you a little bit more about what kind of technology you think that they actually, those are running the Secret Space Program, have at their disposal at this time. It's very curious to kind of contemplate of what they've actually managed to produce. We have, of course, the UFO question overall, as you kind of touched upon earlier, but we have the prospect of advanced weaponry as well. How far ahead do you think they really are?
You know, something I have no idea.
How can any of us know?
I have no idea. But I will tell you several stories that made me really begin to contemplate this. The first story was in the early 2000s. I went out to San Francisco. I was in the middle of very serious litigation with the federal government. And I got off the plane and realized immediately I was being followed. And I got to the hotel the next morning. I went up and I was going to an office building right at the southern tip of Bryant Park in San Francisco. And again, I was followed, this time by a man. I'd been followed by a woman in the airport. And I thought, why in the world? You know, I didn't expect to be shadowed in San Francisco. And so I went up to the meeting and everybody wanted coffee. And at the time there was an absolutely fabulous coffee shop up at Bryant Park. So I thought, okay, well, I'll go walk up and get coffee for everybody and come back down. You know, it'll be a lovely thing to do. It's a beautiful San Francisco morning. So up I go and the fellow who's following me is standing outside of the building, sort of waiting for me to come out. I thought, well, God, it must be important if I rate this kind of shadowing. Anyway, he saw me come out, and he must have known where I was going because he walked in front of me all the way up to the coffee shop. I go in, I get my coffee, I come out, and he, of course, knows I'm going back to the building. So he walks in front of me, and Bryant Park dips down, you know, it's sort of a rectangle, and at the bottom, the street turns in to the rectangle and then dumps out. And so you come down, and there's a corner, and he turned the corner, and then I turned the corner, and he wasn't there. He was just gone, and there was no place for him to go. There was no alleyway for him to duck down. There was no way he could have gotten in a car and driven off. He just disappeared. And so I got on the phone, and I called a friend of mine who used to work in covert operations in one of the intelligence agencies, and I said, look, tell me the truth. Do you guys have, you know, can you hit a button and just, like, disappear? And he said, yes, we have invisible man technology. So now that doesn't make it true. All I can tell you is I then, you know, over the course of the next 5 years, I dealt in harassment situations, which I could only explain by invisible man technology.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
You had some, right. Well, that's when I started to realize, oh, these guys have gotten a lot further than I had fathomed. So, you know, but it happened to me about 4 or 5 times, and I became convinced somebody's got it. So that was one. But then the one of the most profound things was it was right before the Indonesian tsunami, which I think was December 2004. And several months before, someone had asked me if I would help them find a World Bond Fund to invest in. And I searched and searched and searched to find something I liked. And then I found two from what I consider to be one of the best bond managers, world bond managers on the planet, and found two that I thought were very good, recommended them, and he proceeded to make a very sizable investment. One of them had 15% of their principal in Indonesian sovereign bonds. And so he invested, and a week later, they dropped 15%. It was a closed-end fund. It dropped 15% in value overnight for no reason. Nothing going on in the market, no change in interest rates. We try to call the sponsor. There's no answer. There's no discussion. It's just ba-boom. It was one of the most baffling things I'd ever seen as an investment person in the investment world. And then a week later, the tsunami happened in Indonesia. Mm. And the only logical conclusion I can reach is they knew. They knew a week ahead of time that Indonesia was going to get hit. And they traded it. There was massive insider trading. Closed-end funds never have that kind of trading. They never have that kind of volume. So you tell me, how could a group of institutional insiders know that a tsunami was going to happen in Indonesia a week from then unless it was a hit.
Yeah, right. That's very interesting. Right. That's a huge clue right there, by the way. Yeah.
Right. So, and over and over now, whenever we have any of these kinds of events, I start to watch the financial patterns, you know, before, during, and after. And the financial patterns, you know, don't tell you the story, but they tell you a lot about what the story may be.
Right.
And what I've come to discover is if you go back over the last 20 years and you say, in a market economy, what would happen to the dollar as reserve currency? It's one thing. If you see what's really happening, you know, the dollar starts to fall and then, whoops, there's a hurricane here. Whoops, there's a tsunami here. And suddenly the dollar's, you know, doing back and fine. So it looks to me, if you, you know, that covert war, the weapons of our covert war are invisible and far more significant and natural looking than we think. So I, for one, cannot explain from the financial patterns. I can't come up with a hypothesis other than we have the weaponry to create tsunamis. We have the weaponry to steer hurricanes. We have the weaponry to trigger earthquakes. You know, I think all of these are weapons of war. I also think we have the surveillance technology in combination with artificial intelligence to run insider trading machines that are beyond the ability of most people to fathom.
That's already happening, isn't it? I mean, the micro trading and all that they've taken over. Not the robots, but the AI is running the thing, isn't it?
Well, I can't say if it's running the thing, but it's certainly the thing that gives the system real power and leverage. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Now, do you think also as well that this would be live drills? This would be testing purposes to see what the weaponry can achieve, and in the process, they decide to, you know, let's make a buck at it, you know, while we're at it as well, right? And that would be the only, because I think that most people who listens to this kind of program, they have an idea that the people in charge of our world, or those who are at least seeking to be in full control of it, in charge of it, only have the worst possible, you know, plans for us overall. But what you've said so far, Catherine, that kind of puts a little bit different spin on it. And it's like, okay, there is a potential for a, not all behavior, of course, but some justification, perhaps, depending on the nature of the threat out there, that this has been just a necessity that they had to do. So it's like a really kind of fine balancing act here, I guess, to try to rationalize some of the things that have occurred in the name of this program, right?
I don't know that. I don't know that. But here's what I will tell you. Having worked at a senior level on Wall Street or in a senior level in Washington, you cannot explain what is happening by saying that the people running the system are bad people. In other words, there's a sort of a spin that we here on the, we here, the normal people are fine and the people running things are bad.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that given the way the system has evolved, we don't see sort of the more the 5% psychopathic among us kind of evolve up, find each other and conspire against everybody else. Yes, that's going on. But I would say that you know, if you step back and say, look, what is happening is not because they are bad and we are good. And what you will find is that there is tremendous popular support for some of the most evil things going on.
Oh, certainly.
As long as it makes the popular, you know, you've heard my red button story where people admit that they don't want the drug dealing to stop as long as it keeps their 401ks high in value and it keeps their government checks coming.
Yeah.
So the war machine has enjoyed popular support to the extent that the average man sees it as a way of enriching himself. Okay.
Yeah.
And so I would say that, you know, that's part of it. But clearly we have a leadership which is dealing with phenomena and they do not feel free to share the risks that they're dealing with. You know, they're keeping those risks to themselves. And they are continuously trying to get more and more control and to centralize control to deal with those risks because they can't share with people the risks that they're dealing with. They don't envision a way to build popular support to help them deal with those risks.
Right.
Now, I'm from the Winston Churchill school. You know, Winston Churchill, the England went through this before World War II. You know, the elite said, look, we can't build popular support, so let's do a deal. Let's appease, you know, Hitler because we can't go to war. And so you had this cycle of appeasement and the, you know, sort of people got further and further cut out of things until it got so bad. And Winston Churchill stepped up and said, look, let's tell the people, you know, because we're, you know, we're going to have to fight. So I'm from the Winston Churchill school because I think people are much smarter and much more intelligent that the leadership gives them credit. You know, we've had a cycle of disrespect going. And, you know, I once said to somebody, look, if you're really right that the leadership is going to kill us all, you know, then what they ought to do is kill the stupid among us, not the smart. And the reality is what you're not doing is you're not taking advantage of the group intelligence within the general population. So I think, you know, I think transparency can solve a lot of the problems that are belittling us now. And that's where I would disagree with the leadership. Now, I think the leadership has the problem because if you've had technology since 1950 be transferred to private corporation that's been financed by the government, there's a real issue of ownership. Mm. Who owns this technology? And of course, this technology is the basis of many great fortunes now.
Right.
And it can be the basis of many other great fortunes. And, you know, and so to illuminate the fact that it's been basically shifted out of the, you know, out of the hands of the people who financed it for no compensation is not a comfortable conversation that I think a lot of those people want to have.
Right, right. So do you think that there is if we look at there's other industries that have boomed tremendously in the last 20, 30 years, also a lot of money that have been poured into this, for example, like information technology, genetics, are any of these kind of the popular industries that we know about at this time, does any of those kind of play into this agenda as well, that this is kind of like a level two or three beyond the top level agenda, if you will?
Yeah, I think a lot of the tech, if you control of investment, capital control is very tightly controlled in North America. So if any technology is receiving investment, it's because it fits within an overall strategic direction. And a lot of that technology is either technology I think we've been reverse engineering out of the black budget, or where we've said, look, to do what we want to accomplish, we need A, B, and C. So let's finance a whole bunch of private entrepreneurs prototyping it and see what comes out. I mean, one thing, you know, one of the strengths of America over the last 50 years is when we want to invent something, we have the wherewithal to invite lots of people to try and fail. You know, we know that financing 50 to get you the best one is the better thing than, you know, going at it the way the Japanese or the Soviet Union would, which is, let's ask, you know, a big corporation with lots of brilliant engineers to go figure it out. You know, you need a distributed sort of decentralized invention process. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of the different things we're seeing now with the technology and crowdfunding, which is they know they need a sort of distributed invention process because it's a lot easier to finance 50 entrepreneurs to try and build it. And then the big corporation buys it, you know, buys the best one after the winner emerges.
Well, exactly. And they never know again where the ideas and where the creativity actually lies. There might be potential gold mines out there, and that's going to be, it might be too good to kind of pass up. But what kind of situation do you think we're looking at here, then, if we look at the future a little bit? Overall, not only American industry, but, you know, industry around, you know, the world practically, when it comes to robotics and developments of AI and everything else, do you see great advancement and at the same time then kind of a picking up of the economy as part of, you know, this overall agenda?
I think you're going to see great advancement in automation, and I think you're going to see great advancement in the leadership trying to use this automation to organize and control society. You know, you're talking essentially about a private police state where everything is digitized, whether people or things, and the internet connects all those people and things in a way where they can be easily sort of influenced and manipulated. You know, you may think of a cell phone as a communication device. I think of it as an entrainment technology.
Right. Yeah. Oh, no. So
there's a very dark side to this. Now, what I have to tell you is I don't think the dark side is going to succeed.
Right.
You know, but I do think we're going to have to go through a pretty, well, I think we're going through it now, a pretty chaotic, out of control process where the dark side is going to be free to try stuff. I mean, it's very interesting. When I built an investment bank in Washington during the 90s called Hamilton Securities Group, and the chief financial officer came to me and he said, well, you know, by law, we really need a personnel system. And, you know, do you want me to hire a group of software developers and we'll build a software personnel system? And I said, no, what we're going to do is we're going to require for our year-end compensation process that each employee build an HTML website on the intranet, and then we'll link them all together, and that will be our personnel system. So we'll have each individual build their personnel file, you know, and maintain their personnel file, and then the firm doesn't have to do it. You know, it'll be bottom up. We'll just design it bottom up. And then when Facebook came out, I said, I can't believe this. The intelligence agencies are doing the same thing, but for the entire society.
Right.
Andy.
Exactly. No, right. You're right.
So they said, yeah, they said it's much too expensive to, you know, to hire programmers and data entry people to sit and maintain a file on every human being. Even with artificial intelligence, that's much too expensive. Why don't we have everybody build their own?
That's to let them volunteer their information as well and give it up. I mean, again, why did Facebook buy WhatsApp, or what was it again? Was it how many billions of dollars was it that they bought it for? Because there was an untapped market of the text communication, because people do kind of drop their guard a little bit, you know?
Right. Yeah, they had a whole generation. The younger people were not getting on Facebook. They were getting on WhatsApp. So, I think Facebook is essentially, you know, the intelligence agency's way of maintaining files on everybody. And even better than maintaining files, having them map out their social connections.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's one of the driving forces. And the question for everyone is, you know, once you build that network, can you make it basically generate enough revenues and profits to pay for itself? I'll never forget, I was in Washington in the late 90s, and somebody came to me and said, well, you know, we've surpassed, I was building software tools called Community Wizard. And they said, you know, we've gone way past Community Wizard. The CIA is going to launch a search engine called Google. Look for it. And it's going to blow way beyond where you were. And then when I first saw Google, I thought, oh, well, there it is. And, you know, and I'm sure the guys at Google had no idea. Now, it's interesting. Stephen Levy did a great article for Wired that was published several months ago where he describes everybody, everybody out of Google realizing that they've been delivering, you know, all of the information that Google sucks up into the dark fiber to the intelligence agencies, and they really had no idea. And I, you know, it was so funny to read their shock and amazement, because I thought, well, you know, in 1998, that was explained to me in Washington as the reason for this corporation to exist. So it's shocking that it took them this long to discover it. Thank you, Edward Snowden.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, so we're watching an infrastructure that has a dark side, it has a light side. And the one thing I would say is, if you look at the way that the consumer is embracing this technology, the consumer loves it, because this consumer loves convenience, the consumer loves connection. And we're talking about a mobile device that is both communication and media and entertainment and, you know, transaction in one device that you can put in your pocket and walk around with.
Yeah.
And the consumer absolutely loves that. Plus, it's delivering entrainment, which is very juicy. So the speed at which the consumer is embracing this and paying for it means it's going to happen. And so how are we going to shift through it into something which is not a police state, but something a little bit more wonderful, as the as the people running the system influence us through the system, I think let's hope our righteousness influences them back.
Is that
it's a two-way communication device.
Right, right. Is that the only thing we should hope for, though? Isn't there more that can be done there? Because I mean, when I'm thinking about it, it's like, geez, that's if it's been built with a set of intentions upon it in terms of what the usage is going to be for both control and monitoring and you know, subjugate the human species, then, I mean, that's going to be really difficult to break away from that if people are voluntarily, you know, participating in that, right?
Well, I think part of the reason that they're doing it is they are terribly afraid of the general population. So a lot of this reflects fear and a concern with risk. And if you look at the general population, we have the ability to impact what's happening and how it's happening in a way that reduces that risk and fear. So to me, the important thing is not to worry about the system they're implementing. The important thing to me is to look at the situation and say, okay, we have 7 billion people and growing on planet Earth. How can we re-engineer our financial system and lifestyles to basically align with the ecosystem? And how can we do it in a way which is wealth building for everybody? We need to make the pie much bigger, and we need to do it in a way that heals, you know, the damage that we're doing to the environment. So to me, we need to solve the real problems. And as we solve the real problems, the risk for everybody reduces. As the risk for everybody reduces, you know, the whole thing shifts. It's funny, you know, I had to, in the 90s, I had to live with very invasive surveillance and sort of invasive technology in all aspects of my life. And it was funny because I was grappling with how to, you know, I was used to being a very rich, well-respected person. And the next thing I know, you know, I'm kind of a lab rat in the middle of this horrible covert operations laboratory. And I went to church one day, and my pastor was very worked up, and he was sort of very boisterously screaming, and he said, you know, you're worried about what other people think of you. You need to understand God does everything you see, and you need to worry about what God and you think of what you're doing. Right. And I realized, oh, right, that's a much higher standard. If I just worry about that, then I don't need to worry about all these other people. And so I got used to living with unbelievably invasive surveillance and got to the point, in fact, when I ended up sort of communicating and forging popular, you know, sort of friendly relationships with the people doing the surveillance, and we shifted it. Have you ever seen the movie The Lives of Others?
I don't recall it. I recognize the title. I don't recall it. No.
It's a wonderful German film about a surveillance situation between the Stasis and a group of East German artists before the wall came down.
Right.
And it shows you an example of how surveillance shifts everything, and the human spirit emerges triumphant. I don't want to give the plot away, but that's what I say. You know, what we need to do is not worry about what other people are doing to us. Not to say we shouldn't be cognizant of it, because it has profound implications for finances and your assets and the management of your time. But we need to worry about the real problems, including the ones they're afraid of.
Yeah, oh, certainly, of course. And I guess the difference there in that setting, back in the 70s and 80s then, perhaps, or wherever that was actually taking place, the movie, that the question is, today, then there was a human being on the other end of that wire. Today we might be looking at a situation where we have algorithms, artificial intelligence,
right.
Machines, robots. Yeah,
right. We have machines. There's no doubt about it. We have machines. And but at the same time, the system is backed up by the ability to kill with impunity. And it's interesting. You and I are two people who have, I would say that you've been relatively fearless. You seem not to be afraid by all of this, and you continue to get on Red Ice Creations and bring transparency to everything that's going on.
Yep.
And if if there is one thing that feeds the dark side, it is fear. And it is by bringing transparency to these things, by not being afraid, that the more of us who do that and the more of us who put down our, you know, what we know and share it and collaborate and go at the real problems, the more we remove their power. It was very funny during the 9/11, after 9/11, you had a group of activists come together to create a website called The Unanswered Questions. And for many years, we sort of collected up citizens' questions, put them into what became the commission. And when the commission was first formed, Henry Kissinger was initially appointed as the head of commission. And the group got together and said, you know, we have to criticize this. We have to attack him. He's an evil man. And I said, no, we have to make a joke of him. We have to make him out to be funny, because if you say that this guy is evil, everybody will say, oh, good, he's exactly what we want.
Right.
If you say he's a laughing stock, if you make him a joke, then they'll say, Henry's no longer effective. Let's get somebody else. So what you need to do is, you know, you need to take the power away from, from the centralized forces. And you do that by not being afraid.
Yeah, so, I was going to say the power they hold over you, right? You remove that and then you do your own thing fearlessly, no matter what.
Right.
Yeah.
It was really funny during the litigation. A couple times I realized, well, if I don't do what they say, I'm going to be dead in 24 hours. And I said, you know, death is not such a bad thing. You know, you really had to make your decision, do I want to be free or not? And which is more important, freedom or convenience? And so we each have to make that decision. And that's what this is about. Are we going to be free or are we going to be slaves? I say we're going to be free, but we're only going to be free if enough of us insist. And you insist by living it. You insist by doing it. You just say, no, I'm not, you know, just like I walked out of Washington, I said, I'm not doing it. It was very funny. There's a funny scene. I wrote a book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. It's up on the web at Dunwalkie, Dunwalke.com, or you can pick it up on a search. But it tells the story at the end about a group of attorneys who got together and tried to order me to break my word on something. And I just said, I refuse. I'm not lying. I'm not breaking my word. I'm not breaking my contracts. It's not happening. And one of them said, well, if you don't do what we say, we'll drop representation. And if you don't have a lawyer, you'll go to jail. And I thought it was really funny. I finally, you know, it was one of those moments when, you know, we call it in America, come to Jesus moment. I just said to them, look, gentlemen, I said, you're not used to working with me. So there are a couple things you need to get straight. I'm obedient to the laws of God, and there's nothing you can do or say to make me break them.
Right.
And if I'm going to jail, that means I'm going to jail, because apparently I need to organize all the entrepreneurs in prison to run the country when the country falls. Cause if this is what we're down to, the country is going to fall, you know, and that was a moment where you just say no. And I don't care what you threaten me with. I don't care what you find. You have all the weapons in the world. Drop a nuclear bomb on my head. I don't care. No, I'm not doing it. And that's, you know, we're all going to have to decide we're not afraid.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, the participation in the system as it exists, that is how it works and ticks, you know, and fear of death has been a tremendous manipulating force on top of it. People have to just realize that they want to, you know, they want to, they're going to die as a slave, or they're going to, you know, on their feet standing and fighting and doing their utmost. I'm not saying that, of course, that people are going to die necessarily, but I'm just saying if that confrontation happens, if that battle is there, you know, you have to be damn certain that you'd rather take that fight and stand up and do the utmost, as opposed to, you know, give in and beg for it. And they're going to take care of business anyway, you know?
Well, that's why the single most effective sort of political organizer we've ever seen on planet Earth was Gandhi. You know, Gandhi had the formula. And when he organized people for the Salt March, he basically understood what it was going to take. You had to say no. And you had to disobey. You had to disobey laws that were essentially criminal. Now, let me ask you a question. How come you're not afraid?
I don't place myself there. I just, you know, my interests and my curiosity outweighs any kind of potential fear I have of other people, what they're going to do against me. And frankly, I don't care. You know, first of all, I don't think I'm important enough to be targeted in any way. And if I was, then okay, good. That means I'm doing something right. Right. So then continue what you're doing.
And have you ever had any problems of any kind?
No. Not that I know of. I mean, nothing obvious, you know, in that regard. You know, we've just been keeping going at it and that's it, you know. So, no, I think it's very much a, don't mean to get too nebulous, but it's very much a mental thing, actually, nonetheless, of what you do attract and what you actually, you know, in that regard, bring upon yourself. And if you do focus too much on running around, and I'm not trying to speak down to anybody, but if, you know, running around being paranoid about things that might not even be, you're just going to waste your time. You know, you have to be focused and efficient at what you do and keep your mind on the target and on the ball, you know?
Right.
But it's an interesting question, you know, but where do you think we could be, Catherine, if we had a real space program that was opened up, a successful one, more opportunity to get out there? We're talking about things like we could actually utilize minerals and resources out in space. We could utilize the potential free technology that comes with all of this. I mean, how vastly would our world change? And are there still any risks along that way? For example, we're still talking about, you know, with the tremendous amounts of access to energy, quote unquote, free energy. We have another question of responsibility and who is to deal with all this and things like that, right?
Well, the one of the challenges to do a major space effort requires integrating what you and I would call breakthrough energy technology. And to integrate that technology, then you need to change the energy model on planet Earth. And that is not a small change, because you have an entire planet's infrastructure that's been organized around that kind of energy, number one, and you have a reserve currency that's been organized around that kind of energy. And so to change the energy, you have to change the entire financial system on the whole planet, including the currency system. And that is a very big change. Because essentially, if you look at our current financial model, we've been on that financial model, the developed world's been on that financial model for 500 years. And you certainly can't do it without rebalancing the global economy, which is what we're doing. So to bring in the new energy technology, you need to rebalance the global economy and shift the entire global financial system to a new model. That is a major change. That is a, you know, that's a once in 500 year kind of change.
Yeah.
So, and if you look at a lot of what's happening, it fits with that picture. Now, I think it's a long time from here to there to do it. I don't know how many years that takes. It takes decades. But it certainly looks to me like they're creating the conditions to move to a one world governance system, to shift the financial system around a one world system and allow you to bring in breakthrough energy technology without having an extraordinary explosion in population that, you know, that environmentally blows the planet apart, and do it in a way where you rebuild and automate the industrial base so that you can afford to do a major space program. All of what's happening fits with that. The manner in which it's happening is not necessarily pleasant for everybody, but it certainly fits with that kind of centralization you need to re-engineer the financial system at its fundamentals and build a platform to really go into space in a major way.
Yeah.
So to me, it looks like we're trying to engineer the financial system and the industrial platform to become a, you know, a space-faring population and civilization.
You know, it's very interesting. I wanted to ask you more about what you would, and this is a huge question, of course, but maybe we can get just kind of talk a little bit about that, what you would propose as an economic system in its place. I mean, what actually would work, you think? I'm always positive, of course, as you said earlier, to hear when people are not blaming capitalism for things that haven't been its responsibility when we haven't even had a proper, you know, free market. Well, I guess free market would be a better word, I guess, because capitalism in itself is so tarnished at this point. But I've gotten real scared a few times when people talk about a new economy, but it sounds like something out of the, you know, USSR, enforced egalitarianism, complete redistribution of wealth, and a complete hierarchical structure where basically you have a prerequisite of limitations of freedom to be able to enforce such a thing. Even a resource-based economy has this hand in hand, as we have a question of that. Okay, you have to, you have a system as it is now. If you want to go over to a resource-based economy, you have to take all the wealth that everyone owns from everybody and just centralize that. And that's going to be, you're not, it's theft, how matter, no matter how you look at it, right? So what do you think could actually work in its place of what we have now?
Well, I, you know, I hate to come back to this. I don't know. The you know, the critical issues, if you're going to try and contemplate a new system, is, first of all, we don't need a new system. We need to evolve. We need to take where we are now, and we need to evolve in very organic ways towards a new system. And that's a matter of trying lots of things. But let's look at the big issues in that. The first big issue is, how do we want to govern? How's the governance system going to work? Because when you look at different aspects of the financial system, you're really looking at tools within the governance system. So you never want to ask about resource allocation or currencies or investment models before you ask and answer, how do we want to govern? Okay?
Right.
Because all of these things are tool, you know, think of these as toolkits within, you know, that are held by the hands of somebody, and that's the governance system. And you have to start with a governance system. And so that brings us back to the question of who's in control and why are they behaving the way they're behaving. Then the second issue is resources. We need to understand, you know, after governance system, what are our resources and what are the risk issues we need to manage with respect to our resources, which is why I keep asking, why are they behaving the way they're behaving? What is there about the environmental issues, the climate issues, the galactic weather issues related to planet Earth? You know, is that what causing the risk? Is that what they're afraid of? And of course, what are the UFOs? Are we dealing with aliens? Are they friendly or hostile? You know, those are all risk issues that we don't understand. And so until you ask and answer, what is the governance system? How should we govern ourselves? And what are our resources and what are the risks that we are addressing and managing those resources, it's very hard to design a system. That's why when people start designing currency systems or promoting solutions relating to financial questions without, asking and answering those two fundamental questions, it's nuts. I mean, let's just posit a question. Let's say the leadership, there's a wonderful science fiction novel by a British novelist, Doris Lessing, who talks about a planet that's dying and how the leadership is constantly trying to get the population to do various things and keep their morale up and not wanting to tell them that the planet is dying. So, you know, and if you look at many of the things going on, they're eerie analogies to to the novel. So the question is, what if our planet is dying? I don't know that it is. I'm not saying that it is. But what if it is? And that's why you're seeing this incredible investment in an accelerated space program. Are we trying to build enough presence on other planets so the human race can survive? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, what is climate change? What are the chemtrails? Why are we going through a time in rotation in the galaxy where the weather is going to be very inhospitable? Is that why we're building? I mean, we're clearly pouring trillions of dollars into underground facilities and underground cities. What is that all about?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think before we say here's the answer to our problems, we need to understand what our problems is. And I, for one, don't understand what our problems are. And having watched where all the money's going in terms of space programs, underground facilities, what I would say is the leadership is afraid of something. And I, for one, want to know what they're afraid of. And I don't want to propose solutions that if I were to know what they know would seem ludicrous.
Right, right. Yeah, so it's a matter of intelligence there, really, as well, gathering as much information and putting that piece of the puzzle together, basically. Yeah.
Here's what I will tell you. Put the, you know, put the possible wild card risk issues aside. There is enough resources on planet Earth, so there is no reason for poverty. If you look at the technology we have, if you look at the ways we could re-engineer government investment and credit, if you look at all the different things we could do globally, the problem is, you know, if we did those changes with a free market society, whoever would rise to leadership would not necessarily be the people in control now. And right. And they, for one, and for much better reasons than you might think, don't want to give up control.
Yeah.
You know, so they're looking for a way to get from here to there where they stay in control. And that's a very different picture than the one we might come up with in a free market society. So, you know, they don't trust a free market and an open society to address the problems in time. Whether they're right or not, I don't know, because I don't know what the problems are.
Right. Yeah.
So this comes back to, I think if you're putting a lot of solutions on the table right now, you're thinking way too small.
Right. Yeah. No, I see what you mean. And at the same time, on top of it there, though, the burden of proof in this regard lies on them. If they are telling us, you know, that it is in one way and then encouraging a system which kind of contradicts those ideas, and people are trying to fight for a different kind of system but being denied that system, then fault still kind of goes back on them and falls on them, right? Because they're not being truthful about it. So that I still come back to that point, as at least that they can have any kind of ideas whether or not, you know, we could handle it, or if there would be chaos in the streets or whatnot. But at some point, you have to realize that there has to be truth in the picture. Otherwise, the world will never be right.
Right. And, you know, it's amazing. For many years, I was an investment banker. And when I ran Hamilton Securities, we did about $10 billion of mortgage transactions, large mortgage security auctions. And we would package together about $1 billion of financial assets and bid it. And before the bid, I would say to myself, you know, I know how this is going to go. I really do. I know the best way for this to go. But I'm going to set it up so that we can have a highly competitive process, not just as to price, but to terms and conditions, because competition is the right thing to do. And I would put it out there. And you know what would happen? There would be this magical thing that would happen. And what would come back from the market and lots of different players being subject to an open, transparency, and competitive process was something far more incredible, far more amazing than I had ever imagined.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it each time, you know, this went on for decades. Each time you let the market work, something amazing would happen, because there is nothing more powerful than group intelligence. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever studied Rupert Sheldrake or...
We've had him on.
Fabulous stuff. And it's really true. There is a, you know, extraordinary things that happen when the group intelligence goes to work. And I think if I look at our current situation, one of the things that I find so painful is the group intelligence is not being allowed to go to work. If you look at the amount of money spent on entrainment, it's spent on manipulation, and spent on encouraging people. You know, we've puppy trained the whole Western world to believe that they can only unleash their creativity on consumer goods and social media, as opposed to the real problems of the world. And that's such a, you know, that's such a painful thing to watch, because it's a dumbing down and a marginalization of a very amazing group of people. And if we could let the group intelligence go to work in a way that was aligning with the leadership, I think something remarkable could happen. And so the question is, can our group intelligence be powerful enough to sort of overcome all the disinformation and all the, you know, the entrainment, and instead go to work at really coming up with something that can work for all concerned? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think you have to start with the truth. And I think the group intelligence can handle the truth. So that gets me back to the conference. in San Francisco. And I have to tell you, it was really funny because when we were talking about the moderator, we said, if we could have anybody, you know, if we could have anybody we wanted, who would it be? And then Yaron said you. And I thought, everybody said, oh my God, can we get him? That's fantastic.
Well, that's nice.
And when it came at, yeah, when it came back that you were coming, I said, okay, now this can really succeed. But I for one, find there's something magical that happens when you get a lot of, you know, if you look at the people who are coming to this conference and speaking, these are people who spent a lifetime trying to find the truth. And they all have very rich knowledge in different areas. And I find that when you come together in person, you know, and there's sort of an intimacy of communication that happens, you get a sharing, you almost create a new field. So I, for one, am sort of hoping that we get breakthrough insights about what's going on and what we can do about it that are really enrich all of our work.
Well, indeed. I definitely agree with you. And I think as well, just to reemphasize the point you mentioned earlier there, that if we were allowed to step up to the plate, you know, if for lack of a better term, that if we knew really what was the challenge for us, I think that just an extraordinary amount of people would be able to rise to that occasion. I mean, as we know, Catherine, we have to have a threat in some cases to get off our asses, you know, to actually get out there and do something different, right? Because if right. we're in the comfort zone, everything is nice and dandy all the time. If you're not challenged in that regard, we tend not to perform as well. And I mean, that's just another reason why I'm so concerned with all the safety and the security measures of all these centralized systems that are in place as well, because it kind of isolates people, it pads them. And I'm not saying that we have to be on the brink of extinction every minute to be able to perform good. I'm not
saying
that either.
It is so scary how isolated the leadership has become and how stupid it has made them.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, these are not stupid people. And yet it's quite extraordinary to me because, you know, when I left Washington and moved to Tennessee and sort of went through a process of moving out into the wilderness, it has been an enormous education for me. And I remember, you know, sitting on Wall Street in Washington and not being able to fathom why people were behaving the way they were behaving. Now I can, but it's funny. I can walk into a boardroom anywhere in America and end up being in the most amazing conversations with people who are extraordinarily intelligent, very fine human beings who have not a clue what it is like to be one of the company's customers and what it's like to be in the head of that customer and what their life is like. So the amount of, you know, the cycle of misunderstanding and disrespect around our society is profound. And a lot of it comes from what you talked about when we first started this conversation, which was all the efforts to divide and conquer people.
Yeah.
So the efforts to divide and conquer and keep people apart are extraordinary, and they're working. They're absolutely working.
Oh yeah. Social engineering, everything else. They're very clever. They've studied human psychology for the longest time to be able to manipulate us in the best way possible. And if people keep falling for it, you know, that's a shame, but that's why we're partially doing this program as well, to awaken people to this, to some of these concepts and making people wake up. But
I have to tell you one of my favorite stories. I have these magical moments on the Solari Report. I'm sure it happens to you on Red Ice Creations. I was interviewing William Tiller. Have you ever spoken with him?
No, I have not.
He was head of the Department of Material Sciences at Stanford, and was able to raise capital to do private research that proved that human intention can change material reality, even at long distances. It's great stuff. And I was preparing him for the interview, and I said, you know, Dr. Tiller, I'm very interested in community prayer, and I wanted to know what you thought of it. And he said, well, you know, you have to be careful. If the people doing the praying are coherent, it can help a lot. If they're not coherent, it can make things worse.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And I realized, oh, you know, what I need to do is I need to make sure that I'm coherent.
Yeah.
And one of the things I've, since talking with him, one of the things I've noticed is how much the popular media does that encourages us to be incoherent. I go to the gym a couple times a week, and it's the only time I ever see television. I'll turn on the television and spin through the channels to see what the news is saying. And I defy you to watch that stuff for more than 10 minutes and remain coherent.
Contradictions.
It's very hard to do.
It is. And I think it's very, to a certain extent, conscious. It means that they're disconnected, of course, from the very reporting that they were doing. But you could see the same in the entertainment media. And if you study that for a little bit as well, of just this complete lack of focus. And it's so obvious when you see it, but people are in this kind of daze, you know, so they refuse to wake up from that. But Catherine, I think this is a really good spot here as well to talk just a little bit more about the conference and plug that a little bit more, give out some of the websites again before we wrap things up for this time. I just wanted to mention there we have speaking then at the conference, of course, our guest today, Catherine Austin Fitz, but also Carol Rosen, Joseph P. Farrell, Richard Doland, Michael Schratt, and also Robert Morningstar, and I'm going to be hosting the event at the conference as well. So please, if you're interested, check it out, secretspaceprogram.org. That's the website for that. And we're going to have more information, by the way, about this event up on the website shortly, where you can read more and such as well. Give us your website again, Catherine, and please let us know if there's anything else you want to mention, either about the conference or anything else you have upcoming.
Sure. Sure. Our website is thesolaria.com. We have the Solaria Report. Come and check it out. The book I mentioned, Dylan Reed, The Aristocracy of Stock Profits, is at dunwalkie.com. That's dunwalke.com. One of the things I wanted to mention, not everybody in America or globally knows that San Mateo is just south of San Francisco in Silicon Valley. So it's in the San Francisco Bay Area, lovely place to come visit and stay. But for those of you who can't come all the way to the San Francisco Bay Area, tickets are also available to stream online. So if you don't want to come in person, you can certainly attend online. So this is going to be, in that sense, a global event. So finally, the last thing I want to say is thank you so much for Red Ice Creations. I loved being on it the first time, and I think it's a wonderful contribution. There's been a lot. I've often been inspired by some of the things you do on Red Ice Creation, and I think every one of us who tries to bring forth the truth as we can find it, know it, contributes to finding the real solutions, which begin with, you know, asking and answering the question, what in the world is going on?
Absolutely. Thank you, Catherine. Really appreciate that. It was great having you back as well. And of course, we'll talk more soon here, but nonetheless, we'll see you, of course, at the end of June then in San Mateo. It'll be a lot of fun to meet you and all the other guys as well. So thanks again for coming on.
Yes, it will.
And before we end for this time, I wanted to let you, our members, know that we are going to have more details about the conference on our members' website shortly in just a few days, with more information about how you guys, our supporters, our members, can get a coupon code that will bump off a little bit on the price when you purchase the full tickets for the Secret Space Program Conference. Jeroen and the other organizers were kind to give you guys a little extra something there as well. So this will be up on our members' website soon. It's not there at this moment when we are releasing this program, but keep an eye out for it on redicemembers.com, and you'll be able to read more about it there and how to do all that. We have upcoming Ingunn Sigurdsdottir from Norway on dispelling the myth that Norway is the best country in the world. Then we have Chip Tatum and Ulla Dammegård on corruption and assassinations. And later we have Robert Morningstar for more on the Secret Space Program theme. And after that we have Dr. Ricardo Duchesne on the uniqueness of Western civilization and the multicultural madness. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your continued support. I also want to express my thanks to everyone at Red Ice for their hard work. Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John. Thank you. Guys and gals, keep up the good work and keep questioning the narrative, okay? All right, we'll speak to you in just a few days. Take care.